Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Welcome to another episode of our Strategy and Insider podcast. I'm Thomas, your host and a partner with Strategy and. In today's episode, I have two very special guests joining me. You may already be familiar with them as they have previously shared their insights in kind of their solo episodes. But in fact, one of them was my very first guest in the pilot episode back in 2019. And having both of them on the mic today, I'm eager to hear about the recent developments in cancer research from them, as well as clinical realities. And without further ado, a very warm welcome to Professor Dr. Andreas Wicki from the Zurich University Hospital and Professor Dr. Bernd Bodenmiller from the University of Zurich. Andreas is the senior attending physician and vice director of the Department of Medical Oncology and Hematology at the Zurich University Hospital, but he's also a professor of oncology at the University of Zurich, as well as the director of the clinical program at the Comprehensive Cancer Center Zurich. His medical specialties are molecular and gastrointestinal oncology, as well as neuroendocrine tumors, which is a rare form of cancer that most commonly occurs in the digestive system and the pancreas. So Bernd Bodenmiller is the founding director of the Department of Quantitative Biomedicine at the University of Zurich, as well as the Bodenmiller Lab. And he's also a professor in the Department of Biology at the ETH here in Zurich. Like Andreas, he is also part of the Comprehensive Cancer Center in Zurich and serves as a director of technologies. His research focuses on the development of imaging mass cytometry, which is an innovative approach that enables simultaneously imaging over 40 proteins and transcripts in tumor tissues. And this helps identify mechanisms for therapeutic targeting and also understand how cells in the tumor ecosystem drive cancer development. And this is clearly something that we will dive deeper in today's episode. But another crossroad here to mention between the two guests is their leadership roles for the Tumor Profiler Center, which has the aim to revolutionize cancer diagnosis, treatment, but also management through cutting-edge tumor profiling techniques, as well as exploratory research. So, Bernd and Andreas, very, very warm welcome back, and thanks for joining me today for the second time. I really, really appreciate the time that you take. So, it has been 5 or 3 years, respectively, since our last podcast conversations, and a lot has changed since then, not only in the world, but also for you as individuals. And for example, Andreas, you did transfer from the Cantonal Hospital of Baselland to the University Hospital here in Zurich. And I'm intrigued to ask, how have you been since our last podcast recordings, and how often do you actually see each other now that you're co-located here in Zurich? Is there even more flourishing collaboration between the two of you, or given the closeness, it's actually less?
No, fortunately, it's a very good collaboration we are having since many years, and we're really trying to build next generation's diagnostics in cancer patients' everyday life. I think that's something which has kept us quite busy those last years. But I'm very happy to say we have more contact than ever and many common projects.
I think this is also true then from your perspective, Bernd, right?
Absolutely. You already gave a nice overview of the different organizations and projects that we collaborate on. But it was by far not exhaustive. There are research grants that we collaborate on, more clinical projects. So I sometimes joke that I see Andreas more often than my wife, which of course is not true.
I hope.
But we really have a very regular contact and exchange.
Cool. That's very good to hear. True experts and very bright minds together, I'm sure, can achieve more than standalone. But another very big change since we last spoke was also the unprecedented rise of artificial intelligence, especially Gen AI, to make it more usable in the broader society. And I'm sure we'll talk about the impact of AI on healthcare in a couple of minutes. But before jumping there, curious to learn, is there any AI, Gen AI tools that you personally use in your daily life, be it for personal reasons when, I don't know, planning, booking the next travel, or also for internal purposes in medicine? Yeah?
So I have to admit that in my case, I broadly, or we in my lab, and I personally broadly use AI tools, ChatGPT, if I'm allowed to call it out here. I really like to use akin to a search engine. In the lab, since we do image-based analyses, there's certain analysis steps that also uses AI tools to extract information, for example, cell shapes that are present in a tissue. And then we will certainly increasingly use AI tools for additional or meta-analysis of the data that we generate, because mm-hmm. the data sets are ever increasing in size and complexity. And that's mm-hmm. really when AI can actually show its strength. And personally, I often, or not often, but regularly use AI with my children, because I want to educate them already a little bit on what it means and what these tools can do. And in fact, they like to invent games and characters for games. And then there's DALL-E and with ChatGPT, where you can work out how these characters would look like and interact with the AI to shape them. And I feel that's an important thing to do.
That's
since I will eventually live in a world where AI will be just everywhere.
This is surely something that I take away personally today and bring back home. Yeah? So thanks for mentioning.
Your children will love it.
How about you, Andreas?
It's actually funny you mentioned your children, because we have started to do some homework, you know. So my children come back and they have to do some searching using the internet. So one of the exercises we did just 2 or 3 weeks ago was the question, who found the sea way to India? And it was quite funny, you know, to use Google and ask the question and to use ChatGPT and see what the answer is. And it was also quite, I think, impressive for the children to see how different the tools are and how different the responses are you get in the end. I mean, they were both right, but in one case you get a very nice abstract, you know, you can read and sounds very well. In the other case, you get a list and then you try to find out which one you should click up on then to get more information. So it's quite different. It's an interesting exercise. Other than that, we've started to use it also in medical purposes, not only in oncology. So, for example, we've also trained a chatbot for family physicians. Mm-hmm. Because it's difficult for family physicians to keep hold of all the different advancements in medicine, in cardiology, in oncology, in urology. So how should they do that? You can train these bots with specific medical content. And we asked in the family physicians whether they preferred the untrained or the trained bot. It was very interesting to see there was a clear preference for the trained bot, which is somehow also reassuring for the medical profession. We're not doing everything wrong.
Yeah, but I think this is a very interesting angle, actually. I haven't thought of, to be honest. But I mean, here we are in one of the lighthouses in Europe of medicine and surely also oncology research and clinical realities, right? But there is the broader world of medicine that is not happening always in a university hospital, where research is a given, yeah, where everyone is kind of very much into science. But still, you want to have also in the suburb areas well-educated and well-trained physicians. So I think also there, knowing shortages, especially in those suburb areas, we'll see hopefully advancements. Yeah? But since you're doing so much with each other, right? And Andreas being the clinician and Bernd being the researcher, put it in simple terms, of course, you're much more than that. Would there be any choice in the past, just thinking ahead of Bernd being the surgeon and Andreas being the researcher, would you be intrigued by that or not really?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Actually, you know, before I started medicine, I did 1 year of studying biology. I guess I told you that already some time ago. So it could have ended up the other way around. and I think, you know, it's today the boundaries between the different professions are less strict than they have been in the past. So I really believe there's more interaction. It's very good that we do have more interaction, but also more people on both sides of the boundary in a way, not just between medicine and biology, but also between data scientists and biologists, for example. And we have many more people included in our research teams who go well beyond biology or medicine today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really something which has changed over the last 6 or 7 years.
So also your profession, Andreas, is then more a blurring of capabilities, being a clinician, obviously, being able to diagnose, make decisions, being empathetic with patients at the same time, researching skills, data skills needed for the patient, not everything in you, but to make proper decisions. It's much more complex. That's what I'm taking away. Yeah?
Absolutely. But that's fair enough. I mean, in a way, it doesn't make sense to assume you can pool all these capabilities in one person. So it's a natural way to deal with complexity, to have kind of a split of capabilities on different people and different people involved and also in decisions and therapies, for example.
Okay. So, Bernd, about you, would you wish to change sometime? Or do you feel already like a bit of a physician as you are coming closer and closer to patients?
I'm clearly not yet a physician. But I would really like to change my role with Andreas for a few days at least. at least having all the capabilities that he has. That's an essential part of this exchange. And also looking back, before I started university, I also did consider for a while to study medicine. So there was also the risk to go on a different path. But Andreas really nicely explained that the boundaries are blurring. And even though I'm a basic researcher by training, now I work really closely with Andreas and other clinicians. So the ideas and the work and the tasks and the challenges that we have are really shared ones. There's now so many demands in regards to data analysis capabilities and understanding and AI, as you mentioned before. It becomes ever more complex on how a patient is actually treated and is moving here through the healthcare system. So there's just so many expertises needed that the essence is really to be able to communicate with people that have very different backgrounds and work towards a common aim.
Thanks for sharing that personal element. And clearly a lot of things happened for you personally in life since then, but also a lot happened in medicine, especially in the field of digitization and technology and artificial intelligence in medicine since we last spoke. And Andreas, also the experience from COVID-19, where major changes we have been seeing, including a rapid development of mRNA vaccines against the virus. Now, 5 years after our first conversation, how do you see the opportunities for technology and data to help fight cancer? And are you actually already, by any chance, using some sort of machine learning, artificial intelligence for pattern recognition in new technologies that you're applying, or images like CT or MRT scans? If you can share a bit from the clinical reality, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I do sometimes also get the question, for example, you know, do we need artificial intelligence or machine learning or new tools? Is this necessary or not? It's interesting to have this conversation in a way, because from my perspective, it's very clear there's not really an alternative to it. Mm-hmm. We produce terabytes of data from one single tumor sample, or we produce exabyte of radiology images in Switzerland every year. So if we want to make use of that amount of data, we do need machine learning models, because if you don't go this way, the only other alternative is you disregard the data. Mm-hmm. And usually disregarding data in science is not the smartest way to move forward. So I think in many places in medicine, you need to have these tools, otherwise you cannot make progress anymore. So that's pretty clear. The question is, what kind of tool should you use? How should you use it? And it's very clear that the bottleneck somehow has moved a bit. It's less about producing data. I mean, we've made huge progress in producing multidimensional data, but we've made considerably less progress in the question how to interpret this data and how to use it for clinical decision making. And I envisage we will need some research effort to get to the place where we really know what are the adequate ways to use machine learning in medicine for this purpose.
It's kind of a given. It's a must have going forward and already in clinical realities today.
That's definitely.
that's clearly visible then. I did allude earlier that you're both affiliated with the Tumor Profiler Center here in Zurich. And this involves obviously a collaboration, approximately 100 researchers and clinicians, meanwhile, from the University of Zurich, the ETH of Zurich, but also the University Hospital of Basel, yeah, which is an hour's train ride away for those listening in and that are not from Europe. So it's close by, but it's a different city. And the aim there is to develop breakthrough discoveries to offer benefits ultimately to patients, but also academia and clinics. And ultimately, obviously, transforming cancer from a fatal disease into a more manageable condition. After the first research phase, where multi-omics tumor profiling platforms for clinics and the next phase of research was done, the upcoming phase will include also clinical studies to test whether biomarkers that are derived from the first phase can actually improve clinical outcome compared to standard treatment or gold standard treatment today. If you could please both elaborate a bit on the details of this very innovative approach, and probably you can also share some insights or improvements that you're already seeing in clinic and research, because that would be awesome to get, because this is really kind of an innovation engine, as I understand.
Perhaps quickly to explain to the audience the basic structure of the tumor profiler workflow. Mm-hmm. We have patients that are recruited in the tumor profiler clinical study. Tumor samples are taken. Part of this tumor sample goes through routine pathology. And then the other part of the tumor sample is analyzed with several different, mainly single cell technologies. Then we get a very comprehensive view of the cellular content of the tumor on the transcript level, protein level. We test which drugs outside of the patient actually show efficacy against the tumor cells. And then we have this really gigantic data set per patient that then in the moment is still, let's say, more manually interpreted and then brought to the tumor board. And they can, in some cases, consider this data and perform treatment recommendations based on this highly dimensional data set.
And a tumor board, if I just may, is kind of a consortium of different disciplines, clinicians, researchers, pathologists, nurses, and the like, right?
Exactly. And they assess the more challenging cancer patients and ultimately discuss together what is the best treatment path for a patient. And so in the first phase, as I said, the data was rather interpreted in a manual way, but now we have a lot of the data available. And now what we are working on now and in the future is to find the best ways on how to integrate and interpret this data for the benefit of patients. And another element that is very important is that we now start to have data where we can also link this molecular data to the outcome data of the patient. So whether a response worked or did not work, and it's really these two elements that we need together to then ultimately have the capability to train AI models that just based on the data can predict the best way of treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's really the direction where things are moving now.
Cool. And how does it feel now as a clinician then, Andreas, being part, I'm sure also in a way heading those molecular tumor boards? What did change through that, or what's the potential of that? Because, I mean, I can only imagine if there is a plethora of data and thousands and probably multiple thousands, if not millions of data points being possible to look at, you still have a limited amount of time to make your choice and decision for the benefit of the patient. How does it feel?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in a way that the molecular tumor board is flooded by data. So this is what happens. And we are moving from using a couple of markers, 6, 7, 8, to using many more. Now, the problem is for some markers, we have perhaps an idea what they might tell us about the sensitivity of the cancer to a given therapy, for example. In other cases, we don't have any idea what it means. Mm-hmm. So actually we did the experiment in the first phase of Profiler. So we exposed the board to this amount of data. And what happens, people use many more data points than they did before. So mm-hmm. It's not that it's kind of neglected. So they capture it, they want to use it, but it's still less than 100 data points. And you need to imagine if you produce a profiler data set, it's close to 43,000 data points, which means we're using less than 1% of the data we generate if you just expose experts to this data. And that's what I meant before as well with the necessity for AI. If you really want to capture this complexity, use it and make something out of it, there's no good alternative. You cannot solve this by hiring experts and tell them to look at data. That's not the way forward.
I'm so glad to hear this. And on a personal note, I'm very happy that this is flourishing and advancing, because that is also the start of our collaboration and where I got to know you. Yeah, so really, really glad to see this. And as we were talking also kind of clinical studies now, you know that we're also as a company collaborating a lot and working a lot with pharma companies. And there is hardly any pharma company that is sizable that is not trying to find its way into oncology to obviously generate impact for patients, but also do business in this area. And I can only imagine that the density of pharma companies around the patients that are limited is increasing. And there is also kind of that intention to speed up clinical trials, obviously, to shorten development timelines for innovative medications, using lesser patients, enhancing patient trials with in silico data. And you're like, do you see this already happening, or is that still wishful thinking?
No, I think it's really happening. You know, when we look at the numbers, so in Switzerland, for example, there's around 180 approved cancer drugs. FDA has approved a bit more than 200. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have around 2,500 compounds running in clinical trials. So this gives you a flavor on what is being developed. And running trials in all these indications, all the different molecular subtypes, I'm pretty sure there's not enough patients, even if you would get every single one and put into a trial to fuel all these trials. And it's just something which won't happen because the numbers are not fitting to do that. And this means, you know, together with obviously also the pharmaceutical companies, we need to find ways how to design smarter trials, how to find ways to reduce the attrition rate, so to find out quite early whether a compound is doing its job, yes or no, to have standard tools to look much deeper into early clinical trials. Tools, for example, Bernd has built in his lab would be very useful in this regard, because otherwise this will slow down the development just because we don't have enough patients to run all the trials.
Perhaps. Sure. One point to add here, since indeed there's so many trials where so many compounds should be tested that don't have any trials yet, I think also what would be needed or will be needed is that patients that go through routine care and treatment at hospitals, that basically what we're doing in the tumor profiler is routinely done for many patients, mm-hmm. or most patients, so that then all this molecular data of different levels of the tumor, and in addition, storing all of the patient data and the clinical data together in very large databases, because this then already could be used by companies to run so-called virtual trials, mm-hmm. or to even explore whether these molecular pathways that they think are targeted by these compounds, whether they even exist. And again, using AI and other tools, one could very well make predictions whether or not there's actually an effect of the drug on the cells. So, but that is something, you mentioned that before, should governments work more or support more such establishment of such entities? And I think the answer is absolutely yes.
And I was going to ask basically two questions. One around mm-hmm. regulation as well. I mean, this is the lighthouse of cancer research, yeah, or one of the lighthouses of cancer research and clinics. But still, it's only local, right? And cancer is a global problem, not only of the well-developed world, but also worlds where there is even malaria still a problem. Yeah. One question being, how many patients do actually undergo a molecular tumor board treatment and decision making? Yeah. And how far are we away from broad usage? Yeah. And the second one is around regulation. We have very tight regulations in medicine for good reasons, but development in data science, in biology, are so speeding up. Is regulation speeding up as well, or is there still a way to go? Probably clinical realities, how many patients treated, and the gap, and also regulation, are we keeping up here?
Yeah, very happy to comment on that. So the very brief answer is not enough. So, I mean, it's just a small minority of patients who is able to get an analysis like the one we described. We've got more patients who are able to receive genetic analysis. So genetics has been standardized very much. NGS has been made broadly applicable. We have around 1,500 patients moving through the molecular board, mostly on genetics every year. So basically, from the capability to run genetics tests, we would be there. So we could do whole genome sequencing in every single cancer patient. That's not the technological issue. That's very different for all the protein technologies. I'm sure you're also going to comment on that, Bernd. So it's much less standardized, which makes it difficult to run consortia over different places because they have technologies which are not the same. They have different approaches. So the only way to do matching today is using genetics. So you can look at all different omics data sets, but in the end, to match with other institutions or large consortia, using genetics is the only tool.
I mean, from a clinic side of view, if you have 100 patients, cancer patients that you're seeing, how many of those patients would currently undergo from your gut, right? It's no science behind. Would undergo that. Is that 1 to 5 patients? Is that up to 20%? Is that 50%? Or how many would you say this currently is?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if you think of genetics, then almost all of our patients are already receiving that. If you think of profiling technologies, we did 241 patients in the first part. We are now running the second part until 2026. This is going to be 300 more patients. But imagining we see around 4,000 new patients every year, you see the numbers are very low.
Below a percent
of patients who are able to undergo analysis using profiler techniques at this point in time.
And here we come at the intersect to scalability. Yeah? And scalability requires obviously regulations that you can scale it not only here in Zurich in one lab, in one hospital, but also scale it elsewhere in the world and control that. And I know that you're also having a startup, Navignostics, right? And that you are also confronted with this. Yeah? What's your perspective on the regulation side? How speedy is this keeping up or not?
So, perhaps I'll start first on the research side, because we just mentioned, like, if in the tumor profiler, it would be ideal we generate this multimodal vast data sets of every tumor. And for this research use only purpose, this is very easy to implement from a regulatory perspective, as long as the patient consents that the samples and the data can be used for research. And that's actually a really beautiful example. It's Genomics England, where they sequence 100,000 people, including many tumors, and they collect a vast amount of data around that. And their research groups, and also companies, can actually access this data for research purposes and analyze it. But now let's assume we identify an exciting biomarker pattern within such a data set. How can we bring it actually to the patients? And that's really where there's a gigantic gap, or you could call it a regulatory desert, through which one has to go through and survive to, in the end, get a CE-IVD approval of this biomarker pattern. And the challenge here is that one needs, of course, clinical evidence that this biomarker pattern is fulfilling its intended use. And in an ideal setting, one performs a prospective clinical study to show that the biomarker pattern is doing what it should do. However, then, for example, to do such a prospective clinical study, especially if it's about informing on treatments, you already in a way need the approval of the CE-IVDR to perform this trial. So you can see it's a little bit of a circular problem. And so one really has to approach that step by step to get this certified, to accrue all the clinical evidence, to in the end be able to show the clinical utility and ultimately to do such a trial. But that process takes several years and it's very expensive. And we're only talking about one biomarker pattern,
yeah,
or a small number of markers out of these 34,000 that Andreas mentioned, that perhaps then is 40, like in our case. And if you want to use another 40 or different technology, you open the book again and you again have to go through a lot of regulatory hurdles.
So I think we could even go on for that for longer, but it really merits a double click also for us as kind of this podcast on the future of health, because I see a lot of tumor biology and in principle biology advancing a lot, data science advancing even quicker and informing disease biology and obviously also health biology, but regulation somewhat is not yet keeping up the pace. What can be new models to accompany that and help thrive innovation much quicker in future? I come back to a picture, Bernd, that you painted at the time when we talked last, that the development of precision medicine is kind of a mountain climb. You did mention the need for obviously significant investments to generate the necessary data, which you then ultimately could use for algorithm to run on it. Where do you see the development then today on that mountain climb? Are we still climbing? Have we reached top already, or are we not seeing yet where the top is? And it's still a bit blurry where we're heading towards, because it's a gigantic exercise. Yeah,
I think we're still climbing. Probably we are just in the beginning of the climb. but since we last talked, I think a lot has changed that now really helps us to see where the peak of the mountain is and to plan a path towards the peak.
Uh-huh.
If I think back when we started to plan the tumor profiler study in 2016, many people said or even doubted the concept of precision oncology. They even doubted more that the type of data we wanted to generate is actually useful or could be useful, that we are not able to implement such a workflow given the regulatory environment. And now looking back on all levels, on the levels of the universities, the hospitals, I would also even say on the level of politicians, I think there is now the insight that precision oncology has a lot of potential and that there's also now a lot of support for precision oncology. And it's also visible that all around the world, precision oncology initiatives or centers are actually launched that try to implement this high-dimensional data sets that one can generate nowadays with these most recent technologies to inform treatment decisions. And given that we now get the support to build such structures, it will still take many, many years and many patients to be analyzed and many regulatory issues have to be thought through and adapted and implemented. But I think now it's really much clearer how we get to the peak. I think we're out of the fog.
Out of the fog, at least. That's good to hear. And I'm intrigued to also ask, and I was alluding to that earlier, we're here in Switzerland, right? Switzerland in the center of Europe where things are possible, it seems, where collaboration is happening, where also required funding is available. How do you see, because that's what I'm sometimes hearing when talking about the future of healthcare. Well, this is going to be a Western world, very rich, only for very selected individuals, the future, when we talk about personalization, where we talk about even prevention, and if not happening, then early diagnostics, and where a doctor is fully equipped with other disciplines supporting him. And then I believe this, but is that only for the fraction of the fraction that can actually afford this? How do you see this? Is this at any point in time scalable and doable? Would love to get your perspective there.
So I think now in the initial phase, when we have to generate this comprehensive data sets, that's indeed extremely expensive. But what we hope to learn from this, for example, are also just few biomarkers that then are informative about a clinical question or how to treat a person given what he or she was diagnosed with. And for example, we had a study in my lab where we analyzed metastatic breast cancer samples. We did lots and lots of measurements, lots and lots of analyses. And in the end, we learned that if you just look at two biomarkers alone, you get the very same result as you get with using this complicated and expensive technologies. And I believe that once we have this comprehensive data sets of a large number of people, we can again learn what is like the minimal set of markers that we actually need to derive very good decisions. And that becomes much cheaper.
But that is very promising. Yeah. So cutting away the fog, and that fog is expensive, it seems. Is that also your perspective, Andreas?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're talking also about costs, because actually we did a cost analysis of Profile, and I just saw the first data 2 days ago.
I haven't heard about that yet.
Yeah, bring it on.
It's,
yeah.
it's very fresh, but you know, we looked at the therapies used in all three cohorts of Profiler, off-label use usually, because it's beyond standard of care. And the really interesting finding, because actually I was a little bit afraid of what people were going to show me, but the interesting finding is, in fact, that the costs for therapy in the Profiler project were lower than the costs of therapy outside of the Profiler project. So basically, what does this tell us? It tells us that already in this very early stage of using this kind of data, it helps to guide your decisions. And instead of erratically doing trial and error and giving a therapy, look whether it does something and then change to the other one, it just increases your chance to pick the right one, which in the end lowers costs of therapy. So I'm not claiming this is a general rule. It's the first analysis. I guess it's even the first omics program ever to be analyzed from an economics perspective. Yeah. But it's very reassuring to see, no, we are not driving therapy costs above the threshold they were before. If we are doing anything, then we are lowering the costs of therapy.
And I think that's also one of the promises of precision oncology, when we're at the point that we can, in a very targeted manner, provide the best possible treatment for a given patient. It will reduce the direct healthcare costs, and it also promises then, of course, to lower the socioeconomic costs that are caused by this disease. Because if people are not as sick anymore for long time frames, etc., they can go much earlier back into their roles in society. Overall, there will be big benefits.
And also pretty easy calculations. You know, combi immunotherapy costs 130,000 Swiss francs per year. If you manage by using these techniques to avoid 1 in 10, which is not going to be effective, you can use quite some funding to do the testing. So mm-hmm. I think the costs of the testing today compared to the costs of therapy are pretty low. So in many cases, it's going to be cost effective to improve tests if it leads to better therapies.
So one of the key takeaways for me is even stronger than ever before is data as such is going to be a big source of impact for patients going forward in oncology and beyond. But it's also a way to increase sustainability in healthcare, to reach more patients with simpler algorithms when we cut through kind of the fog, and then make cost effectiveness more reality, but also scalability into other countries where it's only two biomarkers to measure and test, and not probably 100 or 1,000 even, which then is much more doable, I assume, in any part of the world. So that is promising, yeah, if I hear this. And last time when we spoke, towards your direction, I asked you about kind of the most pressing challenges in the next 10 years that you would have at least contributed to solving with your research, and where you saw the greatest potential. Your answer at the time was about the technologies and algorithms, actually, that you used for the benefits of the patients in clinical routine. If you reflect back, now we are 2-3 years later, what has changed since then? And what is your perspective, obviously, Andreas, on this? Where do you see then ultimately, again, the greatest potential for the next 10 years? What if we would again meet in a time from now? What will we talk about then? Will we talk about, again, about the biomarkers? Will we more talk about totally different trialing, speed of regulation different? I mean, what is kind of the fast forward 10 years for you?
I mean, now only 2 out of the 10 years have passed.
Which is true.
And as you know, I didn't completely change the research direction of my lab. And so I believe more than ever that the capability, eventually in a routine clinical setting, to generate comprehensive measurements of a tumor will be essential. And I think with what you just beautifully summarized now with the rise of AI and seeing how it exponentially it becomes more powerful, this even more demands data that we can use to feed and train the AI. So I think this combination, I still hope that we can make an impact and 10 years from now, this combo will make a difference for patients. Now, what we touched upon before, I think things that personally I cannot directly change or influence. I mean, in consortia with many others, we can try to address it a little bit, is clearly the regulatory settings and environments to bridge this gap between what we can do in smaller studies on the research side to more broadly be able to bring it actually to the routine into the clinics. There's a gap. And if we and others could manage to make this gap smaller or to even when they build a bridge across this gap, that would be a huge impact.
Interesting. How about you, Andreas?
Yeah, I mean, on the technology side, I don't see any slowdown. So the prediction would be it will pick up even more speed. There are many new things to come. Also in drug development, you mentioned at the beginning, for example, the vaccines. Nobody would have thought 5 years ago we are able to produce personalized vaccines within 2 months or something like that. Now, using mRNA technology, this has changed. We can produce personalized vaccines in very few weeks, and we can handle large data quantities and so on. So I think this will keep going on at a very rapid pace. As Bernd said, I'm a little bit more skeptical about the regulatory issues. So somehow regulatory seems to be used to a bit slower pace. And I think it's going to be key for the different countries as well, you know, to move into quick updates, let's say, of the regulatory framework to be able to deal with it. Because in everyday life, we encounter quite some uncertainties. People are unsure because legislation is 10 years old and people don't know how this should be interpreted in today's setting. And I think it would be very useful and reassuring for everybody if we would get into a mode where this kind of regulation is updated perhaps every 3 to 4 years without making necessarily fundamental changes. It's not about changing completely the rules, but to adapt to what is happening in real life.
And since you're also a professor, Andreas, I'm intrigued to also ask, will the education of a doctor, how you are training upcoming doctors, will this not always need to change in the years to come? Because, I mean, just understanding diseases is not going to be enough anymore. Just understanding the usual diagnosis is not enough. It's also understanding data and AI, which ones can I trust, which ones probably not to trust. Regulation, am I in the gray zone still, or is that the zone that I should not tap into? I mean, it's getting more complex. Are we at training our upcoming ones that way, and it doesn't need that to change?
So that's going to be a yes and no answer. So yes, we need to adapt because just knowing about stuff which was kind of making you the good doctor perhaps 15 years ago, this is going to change fundamentally because every machine, every computer will beat you easily on this. So it should not be the way how you excel beyond anybody else. Okay. But this was a no part because if we use all the tools we talked about, for example, we will move from a more static kind of guideline, which is based on a clinical trial, to an individualized, dynamic, personalized, data-driven guideline. But the process which is discussing then the guideline with the patient, I guess this process is not going to change fundamentally, you know, whether the guideline is from a book or whether the guideline is very fancy, very sophisticated, but in the end, it's still a list of drugs, the best one, the second best, the third best. And the discussion whether you want to enter something like a therapy on drug 1, 2, or 3, this is still going to be very similar to the discussion we have today.
Wow, we're coming to an end, and I could go on with you guys for another 2-3 hours for sure. But I really want to thank you for joining, opening up your knowledge to the listeners, but also for hosting us, Andreas, in the hospital here today in Zurich on such a sunny day, actually, taking time and talking about the future of oncology care. Really appreciate that. And to the ones tuning in, yeah, thanks very much for doing so. It was really a privilege for me talking to those two really esteemed experts in the field of oncology and quantitative biomedicine. And I really do hope you found it as interesting and intriguing as I did. And for those that are eager to learn more about the subject, I do highly recommend revisiting episode number 1 and 15, where we had those two guests individually and we dove deeper into their areas of expertise. And yeah, we have many more exciting episodes lined up for the future. So be sure that you stay tuned and keep an eye on what's coming next. And in the meantime, take care of yourself and your health. And thank you and goodbye.
Strategy and Strategy made real.